Welcome to Thriller Radio, your premier internet radio station for live interviews with best-selling writers and movers and shakers of the publishing world. Visit our website at www.thrillerradio.org and follow us on Twitter at Thriller Radio. And now, here's your host, Joshua Graham.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. This is Joshua Graham here with Thriller Radio. Today, our guests are the dynamic duo of thriller novels, number one New York Times and number one Wall Street Journal best-selling authors. They've written 13 of the Pendergast novels, the first of which was Relic from 1995. And the most recent one, White Fire, was just released recently, I think maybe even yesterday. Both amazing individual authors in their own right. They've thrilled readers with series novels, including the Pendergast books as well as the Gideon Crew books. And, of course, I'm referring to the amazing Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Gentlemen, welcome to Thriller Radio.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Josh.
Great to have you both with us. Now, since we have two of you, some of the questions I'll ask I'll direct by name to each one of you, and others I'll pass out for either one of you to answer and duke it out as to who's going to answer. But I just want to say congratulations on the new book, White Fire, which was just released to the delight of Pendergast fans everywhere. If you would, please give us an update about what this latest adventure is about.
Well, the best way to do that is to probably tell you how the idea got started. About 2 years ago, I was reading a biography of Oscar Wilde, and I came across the remarkable, to me anyway, fact that one night he had dinner in London at a very posh hotel with none other than Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, author of Sherlock Holmes books. And this was very early in both of their careers, and I was shocked that the Prince of English Decadence would have anything to say to the fairly, standard Colonel Blimp figure of Conan Doyle. And I began to wonder what they could possibly have talked about. And first it occurred to me that wouldn't it be interesting if Wilde had given Doyle tips on how to improve his character, make him more loose, make him more sort of misanthropic, and give him a cocaine habit. And what if Wilde had learned from Doyle's singular book that had been published at that point about police techniques, which he could then use in his own book, The Picture of Dorian Gray. But even more importantly than that, I knew there was a story there somewhere. There had to be a Pendergast novel in this. And so I immediately called up Doug, and we talked about it, and he had some brilliant ideas on how to develop it. And we just took the ball and didn't stop running from that point on.
And Doug, from your point of view, was there like an aha moment when the two of you talked about it for the first time?
Well, there was. When Link called me up, I thought, well, wait a minute. You know, this is a dinner that happened 100 years ago. How are we going to turn that into a contemporary story? Because White Fire takes place in the present day. But it didn't take long for us to figure out how we would... The first chapter of White Fire is that meeting in the Langham Hotel, but then the rest of the novel takes place in the present day in a posh Colorado ski resort that resembles Aspen, Colorado, although we call it Roaring Fork because we did... change the geography and so forth, but you know it's quite a lot like Aspen.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the thing. I don't want to spoil the story by telling you what the connection is between that mm-hmm. dinner and what happens in Roaring Fork, Colorado, at the ski resort in the present day. But there is an interesting and kind of crazy connection involving. Well, here's the thing. One of the things we discovered was that Oscar Wilde had done a lecture tour of America shortly before this mm-hmm. dinner. And he had actually been to Colorado, and he lectured a group of unruly drunken miners. He lectured to them on the aesthetic principles of house decoration and personal adornment. And he got a standing ovation. These miners just loved it. I mean, I guess they were kind of tired of whoring and drinking, and Oscar Wilde presented something new. And he actually delivered this lecture in the gallery of a large mine. And so we thought, this is so cool. And this is how we managed to connect events that occurred in the 19th century in this mining camp with the present-day chic ski resort that it had become. And so the book opens with Corey Swanson, our character, going to this ski resort to look at the bodies or the remains of 11 miners who were killed and eaten by a grizzly bear back in the 19th century. And she's studying forensic, criminology, and this is a chance for her to write her thesis on paramortem trauma of a large carnivore inflicted on human skeletons, which is, what her thesis is going to be on. And she gets herself into serious trouble in Roaring Fork, and Pendergast has to come and rescue her.
Wow. What an amazing tie. Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Doug had read a book about bears. Tell him about that. That was really the crux of what we had to think of something that would send, at the end of this dinner, Oscar Wilde had to say something to Conan Doyle that would send him rushing off, in distress and disgust, and that would sort of jumpstart our story, and there would be a link to the past and the present. So, Doug, tell Josh about your own experience. And why I gave the idea for the bears.
Well,
years
ago, just before I was to go backpacking in Glacier National Park, I picked up a book in the ranger station called Night of the Grizzlies. And it told the true story about how two different grizzly bears in two different parts of the park had killed and eaten backpackers. I mean, literally dragged them out of their tents, crunched them up, and left their body parts strewn all through the forest.
Ooh.
It was the most terrifying book I've ever read, and it really ruined my backpacking trip. But I thought, boy, if you're looking for something really frightening, being attacked and mauled and eaten by a grizzly bear has got to be one of the most awful things that could happen to a human being. So that's where I got the idea.
Well, I think the term grizzly is well-earned for those bears. So in Whitefire, you're featuring Agent Pendergast's protege, Corey Swanson, and apparently she appeared in the 2003 thriller Still Life with Crows, and she's grown up a bit since. Can you tell us about her and how she got to be where she is today in Whitefire?
Well, Corey Swanson in Still Life with Crows was a high school student who was in trouble. She had been held back a year in high school because she'd gotten into trouble and missed part of the year, and Pendergast kind of hires her in a weird way to be his protege in that story because he needs someone in this small town in Kansas who knows everybody and will help him navigate the small town atmosphere where there's a serial killer, killing people. Well, she's grown up a bit. She's now a student at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City, which is one of the premier law enforcement colleges in the country, and she's studying forensic criminology, and she's writing her thesis. As I mentioned, she's looking for a thesis topic, and she decides to do it on paramortem trauma, which means trauma inflicted at the time of death by a large carnivore on human remains. Now, that doesn't sound like something that criminology would be involved with, but in fact it is, because many, murder victims who are found weeks or months later, their skeletons are found in the woods, have been gnawed on by animals. So a lot of the time, a criminologist has to figure out what marks on the bone were caused by animals biting and gnawing, coyotes or whatever, and what marks were caused by the murderer who killed this person. And that's a very difficult scientific question. So this is what Corey's studying as part of her thesis. And that's why she goes out to Colorado. There's a development in this ski resort where they've exhumed an old historic cemetery where these 11 miners were buried who were killed and eaten by a grizzly bear. And they've put their skeletons in a ski warehouse in these plastic coffins, you know, in preparation for moving them somewhere else. And so Corey sees this as a great opportunity to go out to and study these skeletons to see what the marks of the bear looked like on the bones. But unfortunately, she gets herself into trouble, and she also makes a really horrific discovery, I mean, which is even worse than a man-eating grizzly bear, and I can't tell you what it is. Mm-hmm. But so Pendergast has to come and rescue her, and this discovery really threatens the entire existence of this resort. And so it really stirs up a hornet's nest. And so that's sort of how the novel begins.
Wow. And she basically steps into something and uncovers something that just kind of gets the whole snowball going. That's really exciting. All right, so let me direct this question towards Lincoln so we get a little synergy going here. Pendergast has been through quite a bit now, over 13 novels. Can you tell us a little bit about his, you can be as detailed as you like or not detailed, but about his arc so far, I mean, starting from book one until now, where has he been and what's he going through and where do you see him headed?
Sure. In the initial novels, Pendergast was almost a secondary figure and a very eccentric, intelligent FBI agent who would slide into the scene at the appropriate time and make very amusing and interesting deductions and then sort of slide back out. And Doug and I would sort of accrete various events to him and aspects to him, like such as we implied that his wife had died years ago in a hunting accident and that he was wealthy and he came from a southern background. But with our book, The Cabinet of Curiosities, where we dusted him off and brought him back in after writing some non-Pendergast adventure novels, something clicked, and our readers really began to take notice of him, and we also felt like, wow, this is a character we could really, stir up and make dance. And after that, we devoted our energies to his life in particular. And he solved several cases as the leading character, and in so doing, his own personal life seemed to be sort of pressed forward. His ancestors and some of their unfortunate escapades. His own brother, and people began to tell us, well, you know, we love Pendergast, but he seems kind of like a Superman. So in some of the more recent novels, we've had him plagued by tragedy. You know, a wife that he thought was long dead of a hunting accident turned out to have been killed. And that propelled us into a trilogy we call the Helen Trilogy, and which ended with Two Graves after starting with Fever Dream. And Two Graves is a Pendergast novel that immediately predates White Fire. And at the end of that book, he's really gone through a lot. And he's basically taken a year or two to just travel the world and lose himself in poetry and absinthe and just turn away from the problems of others. And it's really Corey and her situation, which is his first step back into the FBI and into solving cases, and which precipitates him to leave Cap Ferrat in France and go to Roaring Fork and rescue her. And then it's immediately afterwards, in Roaring Fork, a series of horrific arson killings where huge, gaudy mansions are burned down with their occupants trapped inside by some crazed arsonist that compels him to stay to try and solve this case. And so as a result, the events in Whitefire, Corey and the arson attacks, are really what bring him back to himself and back to the world as we know it, and to his career as an FBI special agent.
Wow, it really does sound like without even having gone through that much detail, it really sounds like he has gone through a lot. And I know that writers tend to get the most out of their characters, put them through hell, and you know, a few times. Just out of curiosity, about what age is Pendergast?
He seems to be slowing down in his growing process as the novels, you know, go on. I think that I don't know, Doug. I would guess him to be about 45. What do you think?
Yeah, I see him between 43 and 45 generally.
When we first started writing, he was a bit older than we were, and now he's a bit younger than we are.
Well, I guess that's a nice thing about not indicating specifically, because it can fit within the reader or even the writer's imagination, and they can live forever pretty much. So, okay, Doug, here's a question for you. This is about the two of you, and I'm sure you get asked this all the time, but for some of our listeners who don't know your team backstory, how did the two of you, you and Lincoln, how did the two of you come together and team up?
Well, I was working at the Museum of Natural History in New York, and Lincoln was an editor at St. Martin's Press, which is a book publishing company in New York, and he called me up out of the blue, cold call. He said, I've been reading your columns in the museum's magazine, and he asked me if I would write a book about the museum, a nonfiction book, and so I did, and it was published as Dinosaurs in the Attic, and that was my first book. And when that was all done, Lincoln... he said to me, look, I want to get a tour of all these weird storage rooms in the museum, these back areas that no one ever sees. And I said, well, look, Link, I really can't give you that tour because I'm just a lowly employee here. And, well, he kept bugging me and pressuring me to arrange this tour. So finally I said, look, all right, I can give you the tour, because I had a key that got into a lot of these areas. But we have to do it late at night when no one's around, so I won't be challenged. You know, what are you doing here? So I did that. I gave Link this tour, and I think about 2 o'clock in the morning, we ended up in one of the dinosaur halls, and Link turned to me and he said, oh, my God, this is the scariest building in the world. We have got to write a thriller set in this building. And we ended up writing Relic, and it was a great success. It was made into a movie by Paramount Pictures, and that's how our writing partnership began.
That's amazing. Inspired by real settings and that type of thing. So, Lincoln, you were acquiring both fiction and nonfiction at the time, and what actually made you get so curious about wanting to get this tour?
Well, my wife and I were huge fans of the museum. She was a docent there, and we were members, and we took all the tours and got the magazine, and you know, the tours that you get normally are interesting, but they just sort of scratch the surface. You know, you sort of wander down some hallway and then you get a glimpse down this much more interesting hallway where you see Indiana Jones just back from looting a tomb, sitting at his desk with his pith helmet, you know, sitting propped on the desk, and you wonder, wow, what's going on back there? And I noticed that in Natural History magazine there were a lot of articles about the people who had made the museum great back in the grand old days of exploration and depredation and artifact collecting, and one name seemed to be associated with a lot of these articles, and that was Doug, and so my ambition to write a history of the museum quickly changed, and I said, why the hell should I go to all the effort to do all this research and everything when I've got somebody tailor-made here, some sap who can do it all for me? And Doug had a great opportunity to sort of recycle some of his articles and do others in more depth and do more, you know, primary research of his own. And so it really was it was something that was beneficial to both of us. You know, I got a book out of it. Editors are like sharks. You have to keep on acquiring books or you drown, basically. And, and it gave Doug a chance to expand his writing from article length to full book length. So it really was something that was great for both of us. And it also then sort of kick-started Relic, which was a thriller set in a museum. at the same time.
Well, that's amazing. And for Doug, you'd already been writing and been published doing nonfiction. Fiction and nonfiction are obviously very different in terms of the writing process. How much of a learning curve was there? Was it a very different experience when you first started writing Relic?
Well, it was. It was very different. But, you know, I was really fortunate to have Lincoln as my partner, because Lincoln had been editing a lot of fiction, in his years at St. Martin's Press. And, I mean, I hope he won't mind if I say that he once told me he most of what he learned from reading bad manuscripts, because he said he really learned what not to do. And he learned what doesn't work in writing fiction. And whenever I started to do that, when I was writing a draft of a chapter, he'd come back at me and say, look, Doug, this doesn't work, and here's why. And it was an incredible education for me. And I was able to bring to the table my knowledge of the museum, of nonfiction, and I think also character development and certain things. And Lincoln was able to bring to the table this incredible knowledge of how to construct a tight, action-filled page-turner of a thriller. And so working together, our first novel, Relic, was just a huge success and made into a movie and everything else. And I really credit Lincoln's guidance with that, and I think Lincoln credits all the bad manuscripts he had to read. Is that right, Link?
Well, yes, and I also credit the good manuscript that you wrote for the success of Relic.
Well, thank you.
But my mentor, Tom McCormick, the head of St. Martin's Press, would frequently say that, you know, an editor had to be like a doctor. You know, a reader could put down a book and say, gee, that wasn't really very good, you know. I think I'll try something else. But the editor has to say, well, that wasn't very good, and the reason why it wasn't good was because the protagonist doesn't grow over the course of the story, and, you know, this subplot has a dead end and doesn't do anything. You know, the editor has to be able to put his finger on what is wrong with the book and how to fix it. And
right.
It was his guidance and his gentle and sometimes not so gentle pressure on me to make that kind of diagnosis that really helped me to in my career as an editor.
And obviously it's done really well, because with Relic's great success, you guys have had this long-standing, just brilliant career as writers, and hitting New York Times bestseller number one and Wall Street Journal and just millions of people all over the world enjoying your books. So it's obviously the team that you guys forged together, it's just like the perfect combination. Now, I'm curious, Lincoln, when Doug mentioned you learn more from what not to do, because some of our listeners are obviously writers too. Could you just toss out a couple of those nuggets of what you learned from bad manuscripts not to do?
Well, I touched on a bit of that already. It's one thing is to know the proportion of anything, you know, make sure that you keep your character descriptions balanced. You don't want to go on at great length about any one thing. You want to make sure that you keep everything taut. My personal advice would be, I try and write very visually. You know, keep the chapters short. Keep them like scenes of a movie. Try and end on an exciting moment. Try and involve your readers with your characters. You know, try and delineate each character crisply and sharply. You know, make a list of their likes and dislikes and what their backstory is. Try and bring out their characters through what they have to say, you know, rather than what they do, almost like a screenplay would do. And at the end of the day, step back, survey your book, and as Dr. Johnson would have said, find your favorite little beauties and take them out, because invariably they're the worst part of the story. And Doug has done that to me many times, and I've probably done it to him many times, when you've got a favorite sentence and, you know, you get the thing back from your co-author after revising it, and that sentence is gone. So you have to learn how to police yourself.
I think that's great, because, you know, being a writer myself, I know that oftentimes you write and you think something's good, and then you take somebody outside of yourself to kind of reflect back to you and show you, that wasn't that great. Somebody who can be honest and whose opinion you respect and trust. So, you know, the two of you having that with each other, I think that's got to be a really great, I bet there's probably moments for some disagreement and things like that, but overall the net result must be very profitable for you both. Now, about the team writing process, I don't want to belabor this too much because obviously you guys have done this so much and talked about it so much, but is there anything particularly interesting that people might not realize about being a co-author team?
Well, you kind of just touched on it. I think the most important thing is you have to trust your partner's judgment. And it is true, Lincoln will call me up and say, Doug, this chapter just doesn't work. It stinks. And my first reaction is, what the hell do you know, you troglodyte, you Philistine.
But, you homunculus.
You homunc, And then we often have, arguments. And some of us will take great umbrage at what the other has said. But at the end of the day, you have to trust your partner's judgment. And I've learned that Lincoln, if he says something is wrong, he's always right. He may not, identify exactly how to fix it, but if he doesn't like it, if he feels something is wrong, there's definitely something that needs to be fixed. And I just have to swallow, my anger and irritation and get back to work. And I think Lincoln, feels the same way when I say to him that something needs to be fixed. It's the trust is really important. I mean, we also have to learn how to argue with each other. Sometimes I feel like we're an old married couple, squabbling constantly. But the process requires criticism. I mean, I have to criticize him. He has to criticize me. We actually have to argue with each other. That's how it works. And so we had to learn how to argue constructively rather than, so-and-so, I can't even say the words that we used to say to each other, sometimes hanging up the phone in fury or flaming each other through the Internet. But you have to learn how to argue. And I think Lincoln and I have done that. And when we have disagreements now, we often end up, with something that's actually better than what either one of us wanted in the end.
Do you want to weigh in on the same topic, Lincoln?
No, Doug has done a good job of articulating
okay.
it. The one thing I would add is that we have to check our egos at the door. If you have a partnership, you can't go in, and be easily offended. But I would like to, while we have time, bring the subject back to Whitefire for a moment because there's something very unusual about this book that I wanted to mention to you and to your listeners, if I may.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
We started the book with a scene set in the past with Oscar Wilde and Sherlock and Conan Doyle, and a lot of bear killings that have been done in the 19th century. And Pendergast is confronted with a bunch of new arson cases, horrible arson cases, in the present day. And so we were left with a huge problem: how to link the past with the present. What could those old bear killings and these new arson killings have in common? Doug thought up a brilliant connection between those that I can't tell you. It would spoil the book. But at the same time, we wanted to bring, since we had Conan Doyle in the story, we wanted to bring Sherlock Holmes into the picture because people are always saying, Pendergast and Sherlock Holmes have similarities, don't you think? And so we thought, well, this is a chance for us to really, play at those similarities. So I said to Doug, hey, Doug, I have an idea. What if there's some Sherlock Holmes story that Conan Doyle wrote and we play on this as a kind of trope, that there's a lost Sherlock Holmes story that Pendergast theorizes about and that if he could find it, based on what Conan Doyle learned from Wilde about these bear killings and the story he told him, he articulates in his own short story, what if they found this story, it's the clue between the old and the new? And what if we actually embed a quote-unquote real Sherlock Holmes story in the novel, once it's found? And Doug said, hey, great, why don't you write a draft of it? And so I walked away a bit nervous and crestfallen and surrounded myself for a week with the canon of Sherlock Holmes and wrote the beginning of the story. And then we approached the estate of Conan Doyle. We'd already approached them to ask if we could use the character of Sherlock Holmes, and they said yes. We said, what if we were to embed a story of, about Sherlock Holmes in the book, and they said, well, we don't know about that, because, you know, they've been burned time and again by these dreadful pastiches of Sherlock Holmes, and they wanted to protect, quite understandably and rightfully, a degree of quality around his work. So we had to submit the first 2,000 words of the story, and luckily they liked the story, and so as a result, White Fire actually has within it embedded a brand new Sherlock Holmes story written by us, which Pendergast discovered.
Well, it's interesting. Link's being a little bit modest here. He did an unbelievably brilliant job writing the story, and I was really blown away when I read it. I mean, he actually disappeared for 10 days, and I didn't know what he was doing, and I was getting really agitated. I thought, we're supposed to be writing a book here, but he was actually reading through the entire canon of all the Sherlock Holmes stories, immersing himself in it, and then he wrote this story. And you know, the heirs of the Conan Doyle estate, you know, the heirs read the story, and they loved it, and they allowed us to put their imprimatur in the book, the logo of the Conan Doyle estate and everything else, and gave us permission for the story. And it really is a really good, amazingly, it feels like a real Sherlock Holmes story. So I have to commend my writing partner on that one. He pulled that off quite well.
Well, thank you. The funny thing is, you know, we had to pay a modest fee to get the rights and to put this beautiful imprimatur of Sherlock Holmes in the book. And the truth is, we probably would have paid a lot more just for the privilege of having that beautiful seal in the book, because, you know, we're huge fans of Sherlock Holmes. We always have been. Pendergast owes a lot to Sherlock Holmes, as he does to several predecessors of literary fame. And so it was really a delight for us to really finally have the two come together, even if indirectly.
So not only do we have this really fascinating and intriguing novel, this what I would call, like, you know, how they sometimes have in these special premium DVDs, like Easter eggs in them, although they're not really hidden. Some of it is maybe hidden, but it's just amazing that there's this heritage that you're able to tap into and become part of, and now it's actually in the book. So for our listeners, we're talking about Preston and Child's latest novel, White Fire, and with a huge connection to Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and what authenticity that's been put into it. This is actually licensed and approved by their estate. So that's just amazing. I think mystery lovers and thriller lovers, people who are fans of this genre, have got to pick this book up, because even without that, this book would be great. But I think that just enhances the readability and even collectability about this book. Well, you know, as we're getting close to the close of our show, I usually like to steer this into the random question of the day. And Doug and Lincoln, I'll ask you two different questions. So this first one is for Doug. If you could hire any architect, alive or from history, to design your dream house, who would you pick and where would you build it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Well, the name of the architect is lost to history. It is the unknown person who designed the Ranchos de Taos Church. And that's a very beautiful adobe church that is in a little town south of Taos in New Mexico called Ranchos de Taos. And it's been made famous by a number of paintings that George O'Keefe did of that church. And also Elliot Porter and some other photographers photographed it. But this beautiful organic adobe church with these huge buttresses. So that unknown architect, I would hire him to design a beautiful adobe house for me in New Mexico.
Very nice. Okay, and for Lincoln, this is your question. If you could invent something that currently does not exist, what would it be?
It would be a fusion reactor.
Right.
You know, I was hoping you were going to ask me your other question, which was about speaking to the entire world.
Oh, yeah, that's our next one for both of you to answer.
I'm sorry.
In fact, why don't we just – that's quite all right. Why don't we ask that right now, and both of you will have a turn to answer that. So we'll start with you, Lincoln. If you could just say one thing to the entire world right now, as if they were all listening, what would you say?
The entire world, right? Everybody,
yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, I thought about asking for world peace, but upon some consideration, I thought that if everybody would consider sending 2 bits to a artist in distress, I'd really be appreciative. Thank you.
is that you, Lincoln? Are you the artist in distress?
Yes, I am.
Oh, well. If only we all could have your problem.
I'm sorry I couldn't resist, Josh.
No, not at all.
Well, so let's
go ahead,
Doug.
How about
my
you?
Turn. All right.
Yeah,
well, I would ask everyone to go get themselves a cheap telescope and point it at the Andromeda constellation and find the Andromeda galaxy and look at it and contemplate that there are 100 billion stars in that galaxy, and to think about how small we actually are and how precious is this little tiny, as Carl Sagan called it, this mote of dust drifting in a sunbeam, how precious our little world is in this vast, great, vast universe. That's what I would recommend everyone do. Contemplate
our
smallness.
You're here.
That's great. I love it. And you know, cosmic perspective on everything. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being on the show, and congratulations on the release of White Fire, and best wishes on all your upcoming releases. I hope you'll come back to the show sometime.
Thank you,
Josh. Thank you very
much,
Josh.
We'd love to.
Thanks, guys. All right, we'll talk
to
you again soon, hopefully. Goodbye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Well, that was Thriller authors Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. Be sure to check out their latest novel, White Fire, wherever books are sold. You can read more about Preston and Child at their website, PrestonChild.com, and be sure to sign up for their newsletter to get all the latest and greatest information from them on releases and just sometimes you get some pretty cool content in their newsletters. I'm a subscriber, so I know. Be sure to join us next week at our regularly scheduled time, 9:30 a.m. Pacific and 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Thriller Radio for an amazing interview with the New York Times bestselling author of The Last Templar and Rasputin's Shadow, Raymond Khoury. Until then, this is Joshua Graham for Thriller Radio reminding you to support your favorite authors by leaving reviews for them and recommending their books to all your friends. Have a thrilling week and keep reading.
You've been listening to Thriller Radio with Joshua Graham. A podcast of this episode can be found here at blogtalkradio.com/thrillerradio. For more information, please visit our website at www.thrillerradio.org and follow us on Twitter at Thriller Radio. Visit Joshua Graham's official website at www.joshua-graham.com.